welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for May 8th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, making bioelectricity or bioethanol, which is a better use for biomass and why? Imaging cells from mammals using infrared fluorescent proteins, and a feature on fighting the fungus that threatens wheat production in Africa and Asia. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about planet eaters, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
One way of converting biomass to biofuel takes advantage of microbes that naturally break down starches and cellulose. The waste product, typically ethanol, is then burned in vehicles as an alternative to gasoline. But suppose instead of converting the biomass into ethanol, it was burned directly to power generators for electricity, which, in turn, was used in electric vehicles. In a paper published online by Science, Elliot Campbell and colleagues report that greater amounts of transportation energy for passenger vehicles could be had from this kind of bioelectricity than from ethanol, and that there are significant savings to be had in greenhouse gas emissions, too. I spoke with Campbell from his office at the University of California, Merced.
What we found is that if you burn this biomass to make electricity to power electric vehicles, you can get a lot more transportation and a lot more greenhouse gas offsets than if you converted it into ethanol.
What are you comparing in terms of ethanol? There's corn-based ethanol, switchgrass-based ethanol, or so-called cellulosic ethanol. Which is your team looking at?
We looked at a range of different types of ethanol conversion processes. So we considered the case where you convert corn starch into ethanol, or where you convert biomass crops such as switchgrass into ethanol. And in both cases, the results seem to favor the electricity pathway over these liquid fuels pathways.
Isn't the burning of biomass today to make electricity used in making ethanol from corn and switchgrass? And if so, does that change the efficiency equations?
It's true that we do make some electricity when we convert biomass into ethanol. However, the vast majority of the energy content in the plant becomes ethanol and not electricity. However, in our study, we did include this assumption that there's some electricity produced for these second generation ethanol processes. And despite that, the overall conversion of all the plant matter to electricity still came out as a better energy pathway.
Is there an underlying model that you and your team used in making these calculations for efficiency and energy production?
Yes, we based a lot of our analysis on data from the GREET model that Argonne Laboratories put out and the EBAM model that the ERG group at UC Berkeley has put out. Both of these models have been used extensively to analyze transportation and energy pathways. We really just leveraged these models in a new way with some additional information to consider a comparison of the land use efficiency of these different energy pathways. So what our papers and some other papers too have been arguing is that the prime agriculture lands aren't going to be a good resource for development of bioenergy resources for multiple reasons, including those land use effects. What a more sustainable domain for biofuels would be is to use some more marginal agriculture lands or even abandoned agriculture lands. And in that case, the land use effects aren't an issue. And then these models like GREET and EBAM are actually a really valid way to consider how beneficial those lands might be in terms of greenhouse gas offsets.
Now, you said earlier that you were talking about second generation ethanol production. That, I presume, also would take into account increased efficiency in making ethanol from switchgrass by finding or engineering the right microbe to digest the cellulose?
Yeah, second generation ethanol definitely requires some technology advancements to really prove this technology at a commercial scale. We considered this pathway in our study to try and get the utmost efficiency of what ethanol might achieve in the future. And the main reason you see a big energy efficiency benefit to the second generation ethanol is because the process energy that's needed to convert the biomass into ethanol is supplied by biomass instead of supplied by natural gas and coal.
Is there an efficiency at which ethanol from switchgrass overtakes the efficiency of burning the biomass to make electricity?
We were surprised to find there wasn't a point at which the second generation ethanol pathways looked better, even when we were really considering an ideal scenario.
And by ideal, you obviously don't mean 100% efficiency. At what level did you sort of cut off and say, well, ethanol from biomass just isn't going to get any better than this? What is the this?
So for the second generation ethanol, we considered about 41% of the energy content of the biomass is converted into the energy content of the ethanol. We didn't look at a range of higher conversion efficiencies because these are really close to the higher end of what might be expected. But as you suggest, if there were some advancements that allowed you to get even more of that biomass energy content into the ethanol, then absolutely that would be possible for an ethanol pathway to look better than an electricity pathway. Overall, what we're trying to consider in this study is a range of technologies that are deployed now or might be deployed in the near future. A major advancement in either of these pathways could change the results and make things look quite a bit different.
And so just in terms of numbers then, what kind of percentages are we looking at in terms of the efficiency differences between biomass into electricity versus biomass into ethanol?
Well, the main result here is a land use efficiency. So the land use efficiency basically tells you how much transportation you could achieve per acre of cropland that's being used to produce the biomass. And when you're comparing ethanol and bioelectricity, you're going to see that the improvement for the electricity pathway is about 80% more transportation than the ethanol pathway. For greenhouse gas offsets, you're going to see about 108% more greenhouse gas offsets per area of cropland than with the ethanol pathway. And these are the results across a range of different assumptions for the types of vehicles, driving styles, and energy conversion technologies.
And why in particular the greenhouse gas emission percentage change? I mean, it all gets burned in the end, whether it's converted to ethanol first or just burned to make electricity.
The greenhouse gas offset is achieved because instead of using a fossil fuel to power our vehicles, we're using a bioenergy resource, which in some ways can be thought of as a greenhouse gas neutral energy source. In the case of electricity, you're achieving more transportation, you're achieving more miles, so you're able to offset the use of more of the fossil fuel or gasoline type of transportation. And that's why there's a greenhouse gas offset benefit to bioelectricity over ethanol.
Because the electric engines are more efficient than the gas-powered ones?
That's what's probably driving the results, but there's a lot of other steps in the energy pathway that we took into consideration as well. Certainly, the efficiency of an electric motor over a typical internal combustion engine vehicle motor is a big reason for the benefits of the bioelectricity pathway.
But in the end, though, aren't we really comparing two different things, electricity and liquid fuel? Or is the idea that they both should be thought of as energy and so considered the same?
Well, if your criteria is how much transportation we can achieve, then they're both the same thing. And right now, it's unclear as to what our transportation future might hold. A lot of people are beginning to think that our transportation future will include a shift to electric vehicles. If we're going to anticipate that shift and think holistically about the best way to build up our bioenergy resources infrastructure, then we might want to start thinking about bioelectricity as a viable energy pathway.
Elliot Campbell, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciated talking with you.
Elliot Campbell of the University of California, Merced, is lead author of a paper comparing bioelectricity with ethanol. Find the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. The World Bank has come under harsh criticism stemming from a report released by its own independent evaluation group because of the poor performance of various projects the bank sponsors. Here with more about it is Science Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny.
Since 1997, the World Bank has provided nearly $17 billion to 120 countries for projects aimed at improving health, fighting malnutrition, and reducing high fertility. The International Finance Corporation, or IFC, which is a part of the World Bank Group, has provided additional millions in private health and pharmaceutical investments. But a report released last week suggests that not all this money has been well spent. The World Bank's independent evaluation group stated that roughly a third of the health, nutrition, and population programs operating between 1997 and 2007 have achieved unsatisfactory results. The evaluation was especially severe for programs in Africa, where only one in four projects ranked as high performing. The poor performers were characterized by a range of problems, including a lack of baseline data needed for realistic target setting, overly complex program designs, and negligible monitoring and evaluation. Among the report's recommendations, program objectives, program design, and investment in monitoring and evaluation all need improvement. In addition, funding decisions need more focus on prioritizing support so that programs focused on one disease won't be overfunded at the expense of efforts to improve entire health systems. And the World Bank Group must improve its capacity to help countries make health systems more efficient.
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Last year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry was for the discovery and development of the green fluorescent protein, which can be fused to other proteins without altering their behavior. That allows researchers to track proteins that otherwise would be invisible just by following what's green. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Xiaokun Xu and colleagues have isolated a protein that fluoresces under infrared light. That's a potentially significant advance because infrared light penetrates tissues so well. That means these new proteins are suitable for whole body imaging, and researchers have used them to see proteins expressed literally through the skin of small animals. I spoke with Xu from his office at the University of California, San Diego.
We have this genetic encoded infrared fluorescent protein, so it can be used in animal imaging, and it can be easily tagged to a protein or a cell using DNA recombinant technology. And this is a big forward compared to the green fluorescent proteins and its red homologs. I will add 2 points. First is we know infrared light is important for imaging of the internal organs in animals. And before our work, there are a lot of small molecules which can fluoresce in the infrared. But the problem is they cannot be genetically encoded. So that means every time if you want to study a protein, then you have to modify the small molecule so that it can specifically label that protein. So this is a big problem, a similar problem a drug company has to deal with. So every time they invent a new drug, they have to specifically target the protein or cell.
Okay.
It's very time-consuming, and it needs a lot of money to do that. So that's the first point. So then the second point is, based on this first point of protein, it fluoresces in the infrared and it's genetically encoded. So now you don't have to modify the molecule for the specific labeling. You just use DNA recombinant technology. It's very easy. You just express our protein to the protein you are studying with, and that's it.
So how did you come across this particular protein fluorescing in the infrared spectrum? It was an isolation from a bacteria, I understand.
Right. So what we have done is the original protein from the bacteria is called phytochrome. This protein is not fluorescent. It only absorbs the light, but it does not emit another photon. It just uses the light for its own purpose. So what we have done is we coerce the protein to emit another photon, not for its original purpose.
And how did you do that?
So I would say for the original protein, it uses light for its own entertainment. It's because this kind of shape change, you can say it's kind of like a dancing of this small molecule. So it's used light for its dancing. And now what I have done is to coerce this small molecule through the protein it binds to say, don't move, don't dance. So you can achieve this goal by truncation of the protein, and also you can modify the environment surrounding this small molecule so that the environment now is more optimized for the stabilization of the small molecule. So when the small molecule spends less energy in dancing, then it will spend some energy in emitting another photon or fluorescence. And so far, we have coerced the small molecule to spend about 7% of its energy in emitting another photon.
7%?
Yeah.
Okay. What is this other molecule? Its cofactor, essentially.
Yes. It's called biliverdin.
Which is found in the mammalian cells already.
Exactly.
Okay. So normally the protein would, as you say, dance, or when excited, it would use a lot of the energy it had absorbed to move itself around.
Yes.
But because you have truncated it and it has interacted with this biliverdin, it doesn't dance as much, but excites and releases photons back.
Right.
And that's how it fluoresces.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. At what energy level is the infrared light that you need in order to excite this fluorescence? Is it enough to significantly heat up the tissue?
No, it will not heat up the tissue if you limit the time, not like days. If just several hours, it's fine.
Does the fluorescence change based on the pH values, whether the tissue is acidic or basic?
The fluorescence is only based on whether the molecule absorbs a light or not. When it absorbs a light, then it can emit another photon. It's not because of the pH change.
So it's stable over a wide range of pH values.
Right.
So at what point then does the protein photobleach? You said that you could leave the light on for several hours. Does it fluoresce all that time?
Well, every fluorescent molecules or proteins, they will be photobleached. So we always need to limit the time. And in our case, we demonstrate in our paper, you actually only need several seconds for the imaging. But our protein is pretty stable over several minutes.
And how long does it take before the body can be imaged this way? And then how long of a window do you have before the body eliminates it?
So based on the technology you are using to produce the protein, it can be from like several hours to maybe a couple of days. And when it's expressed, if the expression is stable, then you can have the protein all the time. But if it's transient, then possibly after several days, I would say 5 to 10 days, the body will eliminate the protein.
And you introduced it using the adenovirus, is that right?
Yes.
And how long did it last inside the mice that you infected with this virus?
Oh, this one, it can last for about 5 to 10 days.
Are there any concerns about toxicity at this point in the development?
Well, we don't see any toxicity when we express this protein in a mouse. So it's pretty good for them.
At this point, can this research be applied to people?
No, it cannot be directly applied to the human research because you have to express the protein that requires the gene therapy. But it can be used to preclinical studies using model organisms.
Xiaokun Chu, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Xiaokun Chu of the University of California, San Diego, is lead author of a paper on imaging mammalian cells using infrared fluorescent proteins. Also in this week's science, mind-body interactions. A team of European scientists report research that suggests there are two components of human will. The scientists worked with 7 volunteer patients undergoing awake brain surgery for tumor removal and found that if they electrically stimulated the parietal cortex, the patients reported wanting to talk and move their limbs, though they didn't actually talk or move. Increasing the stimulation intensity led to the patients' belief that they had actually talked or moved, even though they had not. Stimulating the premotor cortex, in contrast, triggered the limbs and mouth to move, yet the patients firmly denied that they had moved. The researchers conclude that conscious intention and motor awareness arise from increased parietal activity before executing movement. For the past decade, a dangerous wheat-killing fungus has been spreading across Africa, threatening food supply. Last year, it spread as far as Iran. And according to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, up to 80% of all Asian and African wheat varieties are susceptible to the fungus called wheat stem rust. In this week's Science, news writer Eric Stuckstead reports his travels to Mexico to follow the efforts of Norman Borlaug and others who have been working to find varieties of wheat that resist the fungus. Borlaug, widely regarded as the father of the Green Revolution for his research in wheat varieties over 60 years ago, is back where it all started.
Here in the Yaqui Valley of northern Mexico, farmers are busy tending their wheat. Like most thriving agricultural communities, these farmers benefit from fertile soil and irrigation. But the main reason that nearby Ciudad Obregón has grown into a thriving city and the breadbasket of Mexico is because of the research of Norman Borlaug. More than 60 years ago, he created hardy plants that could resist a virulent fungus called wheat rust.
I've seen the misery that comes from rust epidemics and other foliar diseases. But the rust are unique because they are carried by the wind long distances during the summer seasons.
Borlaug's varieties boosted yields, and they helped keep hundreds of millions of people from starving. For that work, Borlaug won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970. And this spring, at 94 years old, he journeyed back to Ciudad Obregón, here where it all started. The reason Borlaug is back is because he's leading a worldwide effort to combat a new and dire threat to wheat production. A dangerous new type of stem rust appeared in Uganda 10 years ago, and scientists around the world are trying to come up with new varieties of wheat that can survive it. The new fungus has already spread to Kenya and Ethiopia, where it is now regularly found in the moist highlands. Spores have turned up as far as Iran and likely will spread even further east to India and Pakistan, where untold numbers of subsistence farmers grow wheat. Ronnie Kaufman of the Borlaug Global Rust Initiative says an outbreak there could have terrible consequences.
And it will mean the loss of lives and livelihoods for literally millions of people if it catches fire in the wrong place at the wrong time.
When Kaufman says catching fire, he's talking about the ability of rust to produce massive numbers of spores that spread with the wind. These spores take a harsh toll on susceptible plants. Infected, they become almost worthless, with shriveled grain that no one buys. While fungicides can help stop the rust if applied early enough, they are too expensive for many farmers. Last time Borlaug dealt with such a problem, starting in 1944, he found many wheat farmers in Mexico had given up on their fields because of stem rust. Borlaug worked here in Ciudad Obregón and devised an innovative scheme that cut in half the amount of time needed for breeding. And so, by the early 1960s, he and his colleagues had created disease-resistant varieties of wheat that dramatically boosted wheat yields around the world. They sent the varieties to India and Pakistan, which were struggling with famine. Breeders there adapted the wheat to local conditions, and the new crops grew and the famine subsided. Mangala Rai is the Director General of the Indian Agricultural Research Council.
This all put together made a tremendous difference in enhancing productivity and production of wheat in the country as a whole. So successfully over 3 to 4 decades, we have been able to manage the rust menace.
But now, this new kind of fungus has hit hard. For example, last year in Kenya, some farmers lost up to 80% of their harvest. Back in 2005, Borlaug visited Kenya. That's when he launched his Global Rust Initiative to help combat the threat of this new wheat rust. Hans Brown heads up the wheat breeding program at the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center.
If there had not been Dr. Borlaug with his global recognition and reputation, I'm not sure the world really would have reacted the way it did.
This past March, more than 300 scientists met along with Borlaug in Ciudad Obregón to discuss the progress so far and tour experimental fields. Ravi Singh, a wheat breeder at the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center, says several varieties of wheat carry genes for powerful resistance to this latest fungus. But one in particular, named Kingbird, is especially useful.
We think it will protect a lot of new varieties by giving this resistance it carries.
So, he and his team are sending out seed for testing and further improvements in other countries. But much more breeding and testing needs to be done. And dealing with this latest form of virulent wheat rust won't be the end of humanity's long battle with the fungus. Borlaug warned the scientists at the meeting that the international network of monitoring for wheat rust needs to be strengthened and maintained.
Stem rust never sleeps. It keeps changing every day and night. It's unpredictable.
Often, people only react to crises like crop failures. But given the importance of wheat for feeding the world, many scientists hope that Borlaug's warning will have a lasting effect. This is Eric Stockstead with Science Magazine.
Science's Eric Stockstead writes on Norman Borlaug's latest battle with wheat stem rust. You can read the full story in this week's Science, and in the online version of the article, you can find a slideshow of Stockstead's trip to Mexico. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. David, I know one of the stories is about planet eaters. Let's start with that one.
Hey, Rob. Well, that's a good story to start with. This story has to do with suns, and when I say suns, I mean stars, that eat their own planets.
Is this really so unusual? I understand that our own star, the sun, is going to be eating Earth at some point in the future.
Right. In billions of years, Earth will be swallowed by the sun. So it's not that unusual, but the point of this study is really to address a couple of mysteries that astronomers have seen when they're scanning the universe for all of these what they call extrasolar planets, planets outside of our solar system. And Rob, for the past two decades, planet hunters have found almost 350 worlds outside of our solar system. But two questions keep on cropping up. The first is when astronomers find these planets, and they usually find the suns that the planets are associated first, they find that older suns tend not to have a lot of planets or tend not to have any planets very close to them. And the second mystery is that conversely, younger suns tend to have a lot more planets very close to them. And so, as you said, Rob, what could explain that is that these suns are somehow swallowing their planets. But, you know, the question is, what's causing that? And, you know, how exactly is it happening? How common is it?
Because at least as I understand our own case with our own sun, it's when our sun would become a red giant really close to the end of its life cycle that it would become big enough to swallow the Earth.
Exactly.
But something else is going on here.
Something else seems to be going on here. And when researchers ran simulations, it turns out the answer seems to be gravity, which again isn't terribly surprising. But what they find is that, you know, when you've got this really big body next to the small body, the big body, in this case the sun, is exerting a lot of gravitational pull on a nearby planet. And over time, it's pulling that planet closer and closer. It's disturbing the orbit of that planet until eventually the planet gets pulled right into the sun.
So the natural degradation of the orbit of the planet, or perhaps an unstable orbit in the first place.
Exactly. And the effect is actually called the tidal effect. So in fact, they ran the simulation on a real life extrasolar planet called Corot 7, which orbits its parent star at a distance of only a few million kilometers. So that's relatively pretty close. And they found that in a billion years, which is a long time, but still in a billion years, that's what's going to happen to this planet. Its parent star is gradually over time going to pull closer and closer to itself until it eventually consumes it.
Well, given these timescales, I imagine it'd be pretty hard to actually observe this happening. What would be needed to actually prove this hypothesis of where these planets are going?
Well, there's a couple ways. The first thing is that researchers could look at suns and see if they have any sort of unusual rotational wobbles.
Sort of like solar indigestion?
Exactly. And, you know, this is because of the disturbance caused by, you know, these two massive bodies essentially crashing into each other. The other way is looking for chemical signatures in the sun. Are there chemicals that researchers are finding associated with the sun that a sun shouldn't be able to produce by itself, you know, as evidence that, you know, there's parts of a planet there now?
Heavier elements, things like that.
Exactly.
Okay, so what other stories have we brought with you today?
Well, Rob, speaking of things eating each other, have you ever wondered what part of your brain tells you to eat that piece of celery versus that piece of chocolate when you're really hungry?
No part of my brain tells me to eat celery over chocolate, Dave. Come on.
Well, for those of us where it is a tougher choice, you know, the question is there something in our brain that exerts self-control that tells us if you're on a diet, don't eat that piece of chocolate, eat the celery instead? And you know, this is something that neuroscientists have been looking into it for a while, not necessarily because they care about dieting, but because they care about how the brain makes decisions. How do we, you know, look at two options and decide which one to go for?
So this was a brain imaging study?
It was a brain imaging study, and they actually did it with dieters. They took 37 dieters, and they put them in what's called an fMRI machine. And this is a machine that looks at activity in your brain. And if one part of the brain is more active than another, it lights up for all intents and purposes on fMRI. And while these people were in the machine, they showed them pictures of 50 different kinds of foods, you know, all different kinds from unhealthy to healthy, from delicious to not very delicious. And they asked the dieters, rank these foods on a scale of 1 to 5 in terms of how healthy or how tasty you would judge these foods to be.
So two different scales there.
Exactly. And then they asked the participants to choose. They said, okay, we'll take this food that was sort of neutral on your scales in terms of taste and health, and let's compare that to the other 49 foods you saw, and you tell us whether you'd rather have your neutral food or one of these other foods.
So for example,
say you chose a cracker as your neutral food, and then I showed you all the other 49 foods, and one by one we went through, and I made you choose, would you rather have a cracker, say, than a candy bar? Would you rather have a cracker than an apple? What they found was that about half the people were always going for these less healthy and tastier treats than they were going for the healthier treats, even though they claimed to be dieters.
And what part of the brain then lit up?
Well, that was the really interesting part. What they found was that when the people were making the healthy decisions, when they were choosing the apple or the piece of celery, a part of their brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex lit up. And this region has been previously associated with learning and memory. But it seemed to be that the people that were really making these healthier decisions, or the decisions that you and I would maybe associate with self-control, this brain region was really active when people were doing that. When people were choosing the unhealthy decisions, this brain region wasn't really active. So you can sort of think about this brain region maybe like the concerned mother in your head that says, you know, hey, I know you're making a decision right now and you should really go for the healthy food.
So now we know where it's happening in the brain. What do we do with that information?
There's a bunch of potential applications. You can think anything that deals with self-control, whether it be dieting or drug use, might be related to this region in the brain. So say if scientists could find, say, a drug that increased activity in this part of the brain, then maybe you could give a bit more self-control to people that don't have it naturally.
Okay, and I see you have one more story with you today. What's that one about?
Well, Rob, this last story is about smart materials.
How are they smart, Dave?
Well, Rob, imagine an airplane wing that turned red right before it was about to break, or supports on a bridge that turned different colors right before the bridge was about to collapse. That would be useful, right?
Sounds pretty smart.
And this research has to do with this realm of smart materials, which is, can we engineer plastics and other types of materials to do more than just, you know, be plastic, you know, to be a support or to be structural or whatever? Can we make plastics that repair themselves? And in this case, can we make plastics that tell us when there's something wrong with them? And for this study, the real trick was researchers trying to figure out, what can we put into plastics? What can we put into the polymers that make up plastics while the plastics are being made that will give them this ability to, say, change color when they start to get really stressed, you know, a sign of that they might break?
So it's not as if they would put a dye or something. I mean,
right. It's actually, they're actually putting molecules into the polymer. As the polymer is made, they're inserting these ring-shaped molecules, which they call mechanophores. And right there in the name, mechano, you're saying that, you know, that there's something that senses mechanical stress. And what they found is if they put these mechanophores in polymers as the polymers were being made, and then they made plastics out of the polymers, as they bent these plastics, the plastics would start to turn red because these mechanophores are breaking. And when their structure breaks, it changes the structure of the entire polymer. That changes its light reflective properties. And hence, you've got a color change when the plastic is under too much stress. And you can actually see a time-lapse picture of this on the site.
Well, I can imagine plenty of applications. You mentioned a couple at the outset. Are there any concerns about using these types of materials with these kinds of built-in sensing abilities, if you will?
Well, one potential problem right now is that these materials can reverse back to their original colors if, say, a certain type of light shines on them. So that's a big problem because, you know, if you've got a bridge and the supports on the bridge are turning red and you don't catch it while it's red and, you know, it reverts back to its original color again, then something's wrong and you don't know about it. You're back in square one. So this is a technology that's still at its early stages, but it, as you said, it's showing a lot of promise and there's a lot of potential applications once they really get it refined.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into a story about DNA origami, folding DNA into various shapes for various purposes, and also a disappearing act for the world's second largest fish. Scientists have finally figured out where this shark is going when it's disappearing. And on the policy blog, Science Insider, we're continuing our regular coverage of swine flu. We've got updates. We've had a lot of exclusive interviews with some of the big people involved with the flu. But we've got a lot of non-flu news as well. You know, with President Obama's stimulus package, there's been a flood of applications to the NIH because the NIH has made some money available for extra scientific grants, what they're calling challenge grants. And so far, the NIH has been flooded with 15,000 applications, and that number seems to be rising. And also a story about the Pentagon's hackers. It turns out that the cyber attack capabilities of the United States are probably more powerful than the most sophisticated cyber attacks perpetrated by cyber criminals. So that's a really interesting item as well. You can find all these items on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.com. And that wraps up the May 8th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.